The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
Mike
most
Lupica
prominent
has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us again on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we are joined by a dear old friend of mine, number one New York Times best-selling author, big deal in TV now. His latest book is set to release on March 19th, titled Runaway. Here to discuss his latest project and much more is the great Harlan Coben. But before we get started with Harlan, I want to tell you about Geico. There's a quick way you could save money to switch to Geico. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And Geico offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? Geico's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet Geico's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast. And this is one I've been wanting to do for a while because Harlan Coben and I have been friends for, I think, 15 years, maybe more than that. And it began simply enough. I became a fan of his books about Myron Bolitar. And families ended up spending time together. And all this time later, he has become one of the biggest selling authors in the world. His new book is called Runaway. It will be released on March 19th. And I'm not going to try to jinx it. It'll be a number one New York Times bestseller because they all are now. He has branched out into movies and television. And Harlan, let me just start here, okay? How the hell did you become the biggest thing for an American in Paris since Jerry Lewis? How the hell did that happen?
Yeah, I am somehow the Jerry Lewis of crime fiction. I keep whining to my German publisher that I want to be the David Hasselhoff of publishing.
Yeah,
so I can sell a little better there. I don't know how. I guess the same way they don't know how Jerry Lewis worked. I don't know how, but yeah, France is like my, per capita, is my biggest country. Which is cool because, you know, the cheese and wine are great.
No, but the movies have become, you know, the movies from your books that have been done there have become big, big hits. And you really, I follow this from afar and through you, but you become a damn cult figure over there.
I just think maybe they're smarter than us. I think they're better.
You think that's
read
it? Yeah.
that's no, it's really been fun. We made a movie, Tell No One, which, you know, did really well. And then we've done two TV shows over there. It's just been, you know, it's been great.
And when, Carlin, when will I be able to go to YouTube, you know, because I've got a daughter who's obsessed with Bradley Cooper, okay? And she found this, whatever it is, maybe you've been on it, the Paris version of The Tonight Show, and there is Bradley Cooper conducting the conversation in fluent French. Can you do that, Harlan?
I've spent, I don't know how much time there, years. I've done, as I spent two TV shows and one movie, and I can't speak or understand one word. It's embarrassing. I need a translator everywhere I go. Even when I do go on TV, they stick this, it's really disconcerting. They stick a thing in your ear. So someone is, as the guy's talking, someone is translating in your ear. And when you speak, another person's voice is going over as yours. I get so lost. It's embarrassing, but we all have strengths and weaknesses, and I know foreign languages, I just don't get them. They're incomprehensible to me, so I don't speak one word. So no chance. That's really impressive that Bradley Cooper can do that.
It blew me away. He looked like he was sitting with Colbert or Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon and getting laughs out of the audience. And I'm thinking, wow. The only way in college that I got through my foreign language studies, this is true, okay? I had this little dopey Volkswagen Bug that I had at the end of my college life, and I would put the assignments onto a tape recorder. This is a true story. And ride around Boston for like a week listening to them. I would pass the test, usually with a decent grade, and it would all fall out of my head the very next day.
Yeah, it doesn't even. It's a mental block. And by the way, it's nice that Bradley Cooper has something going on for him. You know what I mean?
Poor bastard.
He really has nothing else. So why shouldn't he also be really good at foreign languages? Meanwhile, I have a brother who lives in England who's a genius with foreign languages. He speaks 5 fluently. He's a banker in London. So, but meanwhile, he can't write a sentence to save his life. So we just go on.
All right, listen. We'll get back to Myron later because that's what drew me into your ward. And by the way, in full disclosure, Harlan and his family, they were kind of visiting the Lupicas out on Long Island one time as I was bitching and moaning my way through Travel Team, my first book for young readers, and he was giving me constant pep talks. And thank the Lord you did.
Yeah, no, Child Team was a special book, but that's the first one I think that I remember you calling me about and you just, you know, whining. So I had to straighten you out a little bit and tell you how to convert that whining into pages, which is a big part of what a writer has to do. Yeah.
The magic of my friend Harlan Coben's books is extraordinary things happen to ordinary people, and I'm not ordinary because they're smart and they're enterprising, and there's stuff that goes on that just makes you drop the book. Okay, but tell me as much as you can about Runaway without spoiling anything for everybody who's pre-ordering it and will be, you know, rushing to the bookstore next Tuesday.
Well, it opens up. Just quickly opening up, Simon Green, the hero, who's a father of 3 living in New York City, is just sitting in Central Park, just like I was actually doing. That's where the idea sort of came to me. And he's at Strawberry Fields, where, you know, John Lennon's memorial is and that Imagine mosaic. And he's watching some street musician, vagrant, homeless person, whatever you want to call it, mangling out a John Lennon tune for dollars, as you always see when you're there.
Right.
And as he's looking at her, we realize, or he realizes, that it's his daughter who's been missing for 6 months and on something of a drug spree. And when he tries to intervene and save her, everything goes wrong, and we start down that rabbit hole. And that involves cults. It involves those new Ancestry.com DNA tests, all of these sort of things that I try to throw into the mix with hopefully a big surprise at the end. I think Runaway has my most twisted ending. And that's saying something because I really like twisted.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a really, that's been the early word, because it's hard for me to be, after this many books, to kind of be as objective as I want to be. But that's the word I'm getting from most people, that the ending is really staying with them, which I like.
I will read from the beginning of chapter 1. You know, I'm doing this, of course, from Amazon, because as my advanced copy arrived. No. Okay, so Simon sat on a bench in Central Park, in Strawberry Fields, to be more precise, and felt his heart shatter. No one could tell, of course, at least not at first, not until the punches started flying and 2 tourists from Finland, of all places, started screaming, while 9 other park visitors from a wide variety of countries caught the whole horrible incident on smartphone video. But that was still an hour away. Now, see, Dan Jenkins, God rest his soul, passed away last week, always used to talk about the first page test, okay?
Yep.
That passes the first page test.
Dan was the best at that, by the way. Not to get off topic, but you know, some of his stuff. You know, I know you were a good friend of his as well, but I was always a huge fan. So, you know, we're going to miss that guy, and he was an original, and there will not be another like him. I think we can all sort of agree. But yeah, today's world, especially if I don't grab you on the front first page, and frankly, if I'm reading a book, it doesn't grab me on the first page, I won't go to the second page. I was just doing an interview for one of the newspapers, and one of the questions I get a lot, and these sort of questionnaire type things, they always say, what book didn't you finish? I'm like, I literally don't finish more books than I do finish. If I start a book and I don't like it, I feel zero compulsion to keep reading. I mean, I'll stop at 5 pages, I'll stop at 10 pages, I'll stop at 20 pages, wherever it is. If you're not doing it, there's enough books that will. So I keep that in mind. I write as though there's a knife against my throat. I write as though if I'm boring you, you're going to slit my throat and I'm dead, which in a sense, as a writer, I am. So I'm constantly trying to keep you engaged. I feel that's my job.
You know, we're talking to my friend Harlan Coben on the Mike Lupica podcast. You know, a question I always get, and I know you always get, Do you always know the ending? Because sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. What, you know, I did my first Sonny Randall last year, and there's a thing that happened at the end of that book that I swear to, it happened like 10 pages from the end that I had no idea it was going to happen until it happened. And so when you say you've got your most twisted ending yet, did you know that when you started the book?
Yes.
Oh, you did?
I've written, except for the exception of one book, The Woods, I've always known the ending. I don't necessarily, in the case of Runaway, there's probably four revelations at the end, but the main one I knew from before I started. I usually know the beginning and the end. I compare it to driving from, you know, my home state of New Jersey to L.A. I may go Route 80, I may go via the Suez Canal or stop in Tokyo, but I always end up in L.A. So I do know where that ending is, and that helps. That helps for me.
Elmore Leonard used to talk about, I think it was E.L. Doctorow's line, that writing a novel is like driving on a country road at night, and you can and just being able to see till the end of the headlights. But it sounds like that's not you.
Yeah, actually, but I actually quote the E.L. Doctorow, not to correct you, but it's to the full quote is something more to the effect of, it's like driving at night with your headlights on in the fog. You can only see a little bit ahead of you, but you can make the whole journey that way. Which Elmore Leonard, you know, good old Dutch did used to talk about. And I think that's great advice. The only thing I would add is I do know, and I think, you know, you can use Doctorow's analogy and still say, but I know where I'm going. I know the end result. Doctorow wasn't just wandering in fields at night. He knew eventually he'd end up, in the case of my original metaphor or analogy, L.A. So
right.
It's the same kind of thing, but I don't know. Like, I don't know all the stops along the road. I don't know. I don't outline everything in advance. I only see a little bit ahead of me, but I can make the whole journey that way.
Do you outline? Because that's, you know, I mean, and this is not inside baseball because your readers will be, you know, this will give them a chance to get inside the process, because I try to outline and then I never follow the outline. There's elements of it that I will follow, but I finally decided that it's kind of folly to outline.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, writers are a little bit like we of the Hebrew faith. Yes, 10 of them have to do something, you'll get 11 different answers.
Right.
But that said, I don't really outline. I outline a little bit in advance. What I sort of do is I sort of see the next three or four scenes, and I kind of maybe will plot those out a little bit. As I get older, I do a little bit more of that than I used to. I do change. I've written, this is, you know, Runaway is my 31st novel. You know, and I've done pretty much close to almost a little more than one a year. So that means I started when I was 7, you know. No. But that's, I sort of do change different books, different ways, but I never fully outline. I don't think I could do that. But I know Jeff Deaver does, and I know a lot of great writers who do that. I also don't do long character studies. I know some writers who write like bios on their characters that are pages and pages long. They can tell you what they had for breakfast in 1973, about their first kiss in 1981. They can do all that. That's not how I do it, but whatever works, whatever gets, you know, I think I told you this as advice to you, but whatever produces words on the page or screen, everything else is flotsam and jetsam. It's very simple. If it's making you write, good. If it's not making you write, bad.
As our mutual friend William Goldman said, and I believe Samuel L. Jackson quoted him at the Oscars, the easiest thing in the world to do is not write.
There is nothing easier.
It's incredibly easy. When I did used to call Elmore Leonard, and I at first I would be guilty because he, you know, I try to pick a time of the day when he wasn't writing, and he finally said to me one day on the phone, no, don't worry, I factor in phone calls. And so it was quite liberating. I sent an email to Joe Ide today, who I've become a huge fan of his IQ books, and I told him that I used to call Elmore Leonard late in the day when I thought he was finally wrapping up, and even when he was like 85 and 86 and 87 years old, and I'd say, are you writing or thinking about girls? And he'd always say, what, you can't do both? All right, now let me get back to Runaway. And again, Simon Bolitar, who you know, really put you on the map as a writer of mysteries or thrillers or whatever you want to call him. There was a kind of a cool superhero quality to him. I mean, he had a cool superhero sidekick in Wynn. Okay, but these books that finally just exploded for you. Okay, the books set in Jersey or New York City, and again, it's too simple to say extraordinary things happening to ordinary people, but they are. They happen in suburbs of New Jersey, like the one in which you and your wife and your kids live and your kids grew up. Okay. Was that an organic thing with you, or did you set out to say, I'm going to tell stories that I build up out of the world in which I live?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I'd written 7 Myron Bolitar books. He was a sports agent solving crimes. You know, yeah. So it was in the sports world.
And a former player, a former basketball player.
And I love them. And I still write them. I mean, I haven't finished the series necessarily. I write them very rarely. I write, instead of writing, you know, more than one a year when I was doing this, I did 7 in 5 years at that time. I think I just wrote, my last one was the 11th, and so I've written, you know, maybe one at every 4 or 5 year clip now. I do. Right. I'll do 4 or 5 standalones, and then I go back. Part of the reason I left them was just to prove I could do something else. Part of the reason was I really didn't want to be a guy who only wrote Myron Bolitar. Now we'd be talking about my 35th Myron Bolitar novel, you know, then becomes kind of like, you know, how many times can a guy have a catharsis and still be realistic? So I wrote, I hate the advice, write what you know, but in the end of the day, I end up doing that quite a bit. I mean, I don't know necessarily about how to murder people or any of that kind of thing, but I do write about the suburbs. I think there's a cool thing about the American dream coming true, and where the American dream comes true, it could turn into a nightmare quite easily. It's very, you know, joy is very fragile. It's a bubble. So that in this placid pool, if I drop even a small stone, it can really cause ripples. And I think people identify with that. They have families. They have, you know, we all, if I say to you, would you kill somebody? The answer is no. And I said, will you kill somebody to save your kid's life? Now the answer is yes. So where is that line? Where can I get, how gray can I get and still make it a really kind of cool story?
You know, when I read your books and I come into them knowing I'm going to be surprised and shocked and obviously keep turning the pages. But I always think of a line from Gabriel Garcia Marquez that Pete Hamill has repeated to me many times throughout our friendship. He said, people have public lives, private lives, and secret lives. You write about secret lives.
Yeah.
But you believe them. You know, if I sat down in a pitch meeting and I said, okay, here's what happened in Harlan's new book, I would probably bollocks it, okay? But as you're reading along, you say, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
It happens, you know, it's all the time. As you know, I'm doing those shows for Netflix you mentioned before, and they'll say to me, you know, I'll give them this great setup. You know, one's called The Five that's on now. And I said, here's the story of The Five. There's 5 kids playing in the woods. One vanishes. 25 years pass. They never hear a word from the kid. Now they find DNA at a murder scene, and it matches their old friend. So the 4 old friends have to get back together to find out what happened to the missing kid. Wow, compelling, right? Great. And of course they say, well, do you know how it ends? I'm like, yeah, I know how it ends. I'm like, well, tell us. I'm like, I can't. It'll make no sense if I tell you how it ends right now. You're just going to have to trust me. Because if I tell you how it ends, it's kind of like I'm a magician. I'm showing you how the magic trick is done. Now I'm going to do the trick. It won't make any sense. So I get exactly what you mean by that. I work really, really hard on making sure, because it's hard to fool people in this day and age. It really is. You know, there's so many, everybody's seen everything. Oh, you know, that. So to find new ways of fooling you, it's not easy, but I enjoy it. You know, it's part of the challenge, too.
My pal Harlan Coben is a guest on the Mike Lubega podcast. Much more with Mr. Coben right after this from our friends at Kronos. FMLA, FLSA, ACA, EEOC. It's harder than ever for businesses to keep up with today's evolving alphabet soup of regulations. What's a company to do? Kronos. With Kronos, you can minimize compliance risk and track HR policies, making sure they are applied consistently and fairly. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at Kronos.com/compliance. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. Yeah, I mean, no, I'll be reading along and I'll say, well, I don't trust that bastard. And then right. He turns out to be fine. But it's the, you know, it's the bastard on the other side of the room that I should have been way more suspicious of. But here's the thing. And here's, you know, here to me, it's the genius of what you do. We could all be sucked in by the sting. Nobody got sucked in by the sting, too. OK, and you sting us time after time after time. And there's a part of us, the contract we make with you when we pick up one of these books is you're going to sting us. And it doesn't change the popularity that these books have attained.
Well, yes, thanks. It's a good way of putting it. The sting, too. It's, you know, first of all, it's the only thing I do. I mean, I wake up every morning. You know, you people who are listening are going to work, or they're, you know, they have real jobs and they have to be organized and they have to think of things and deal with people and all that. I am sitting alone in a room, and this is all I do. It's, you know, I only have to deliver that big surprise once a year. So in a sense, it shouldn't be that hard. It's all that I do. So that's it. I mean, I have complete and utter focus. This is being a writer. You, as you know, because you get to, we're constantly insecure. We constantly think, you know, it's a strange combination of thinking you suck all the time and being insecure. At the same time, I have the hubris to say, I want you to read 400 or 500 pages that I wrote. I want you to spend 10 or 12 hours and pay me for the privilege of that. And yet I'm also completely insecure about it, and I think that I suck all the time. And this is true of everybody. I mean, talk to Stephen King. He still, like, gets nervous when he sends out a new book. How's it going to be received and all of that? Well, I think when that goes away, and I know you were very nervous about your Sonny Randall book, right? Something new for you.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it never – I think when that goes away, that's kind of when you're phoning it in. I use that sort of insecurity as jet fuel. That's my coach's halftime speech to myself. I need that. So it sort of works for me, that being, you know, insecure. And also it means that I have nothing else in my life. So I'm recently being asked by the new thing that newspapers are always trying to find ways of doing news stories without having to hire somebody to do the story and try getting you to do it yourself. You know, they have these Proust questionnaires. They have these cute profile things. So the new one they all have is your hobby. And they're sending me examples like, you know, one guy loves to play chess and one guy collects comic books. I'm like, what's yours? I'm like, I don't have one. I have my family and I have my writing.
Yeah.
That's it. And I think when you start getting one is when you're losing it, because you're being distracted by it. You're sort of loving your life too much, and so you're enjoying your life, and then you're losing that edge. A quick story, which I know you will love because this is your kind of story. Two famous musicians were talking. I won't mention who they are.
Okay.
But the one was sort of saying, you know, asking the other one, how after all these years do you still do it? And he goes, here's what happens. Like, okay, so you get successful, you buy a house. You get a little more successful, maybe you buy a second house. Then you start collecting, like, Oriental rugs. And then you want to go to an Oriental rug store, and you want to learn more about Oriental rugs. And all of a sudden, you're not doing new music. You're worried about Oriental rugs. I don't have Oriental rugs. I only worry about doing this. I play a little bit of bad golf. I have my family, and I have this, and that's it. I don't want to collect teacups. I don't want to be an antique roadshow. You know, I don't want to be too into the Giants or the Yankees or the Rangers. You know I love them, but I'm not that into them. There's my rant. Sorry.
No, it's not a rant at all. I'm the same. We have the same number of children. Okay. Mine are just a little bit older than my oldest is older than your oldest.
Yep.
And the only thing that I'm envious of with you is... And I know you got the television stuff going on. So you've got your spinning plates too. Okay. I have now gotten into a situation where I am writing two books, usually writing an adult book and a kid's book at the same time. Now, Taylor, my wife, will come up and say, honey, you know, I know you're trying to find out who, you know, who killed the dead hooker, but please don't make them, wander into Lucas and Gramps' basketball game with the seventh grade game against Homestead. And I said, I try to separate out my day, but I write. I've got my kids and my wife and my family, and I do. I play, you know, maybe slightly less worse golf than you, and but I go up in the morning, I don't know how long I'll be up here. It's where I'm sitting at the table where I write, talking to you because this is fun. Okay, but I always remind myself this is the only thing you ever wanted to do.
Right. It's also the only thing I can do.
Yeah, I have no other skills. Harlan, you know this. You've come to a couple of my appearances. When I go around to talk to schools, which I've now spoken at hundreds of over the last 15 years, I always say to the kids, please get your mom and dads to continue to buy these books for you because Mr. Lupica has no other skills. If this goes south, I have nothing to fall back on. And I say, and please don't count television because if I can be on television as long as I was with the sports reporters, anybody can.
No, it's true. I think that desperation, you know, is the missing ingredient when people are looking for what makes writers. And that is, we are not fit to do anything else, like hold real jobs. You know, I was on a panel once with a bunch of writers, and they asked, you know, if you weren't a writer, what would you be? And one of my friends said, a U.S. senator. I'm like, oh, please. I'd be a duvet cover. I got nothing, man. That's it. This is it. You know, I'm always reminded of that old Steve Martin bit where he would play the banjo with his nose, and he would say, you know, some people have to wake up at 4 a.m. and go to a pharmacy and sell flare pens. But the most amazing thing to me is I get paid for doing this.
Yeah.
So we also know we're enormously lucky.
We're talking to Harlan Coben on the Mike Lupica podcast. His new book, Runaway, will be published on next Tuesday, March 19th, and it will explode because they have all exploded. And I'm trying to remember. I should know this because I remember we talked that day. What was the first number one for you?
My first number one was Hold Tight, which was 11 books ago.
11 books ago, and every single one since has been a number one, right?
I had one number two. Stephen King came out the same week as me, and I'm not
that bastard.
That I know.
Damn it!
I did call him and I yelled at him about it. And he basically says, "Stay off my lawn."
All right, now. All right, let's talk about the Netflix stuff, and you got to talk more about The Five. Was The Five something that you said to yourself, do I want to make this a book or do I want to make this something that Hollywood will want?
No, exactly. What happened was a great British production company called Red Productions, a woman named Nicola Shindler, who's done TV I really admired, Queer as Folk, Happy Valley, Last Tango in Halifax. She approached me and she wanted to do one of my books into a TV series. And that particular book had already been optioned by somebody. As we all know, we get optioned up the kazoo and nothing gets made. It's the story of our lives. So when she was with me, I said, you know, I've had this idea that I kind of wanted to make into a novel, but it's been hard having four lead characters. So I pitched her the same way I just pitched you. Here's the story of the five kids. One's a younger brother, blah, blah, blah. And it opens, you know, I had the whole opening. And she just goes, wow, I bet you I could get that sold to, I know, a network that would love that right now. Let me talk to them. And basically, 2 days later, we were started to work on it. So that's sort of how...
But that was it. You just didn't want to write a novel that had basically had four main characters.
It was just, you know, some I see, like, I've done two original ideas for TV, The Five and then Safe with Michael C. Hall, which is, you know, came out last year. And in both cases, I just saw them more visually. I saw them more in sort of these kind of bright colors and in my mind almost more like a movie. Not to say I couldn't have written it as a book, but I just thought it would be cooler and it would work better as sort of a TV series. And that's usually how I decide. In fact, you know, what's weird is I'm doing now The Stranger with Netflix. We just started filming it last week, which is based off one of my novels. I thought, boy, this is going to be so much easier. than going with these original ideas. And it's not. It's not. It ends up being just as hard because you want to expand the story. You want to make sure everything is being told in a visual, cool way.
Where are they shooting it?
We're shooting it in the Manchester, Liverpool area.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's why you were in Manchester and didn't bring me back a hat or a T-shirt.
The Manchester United thing? No,
yeah,
I go to Manchester quite frequently. That's where
It's okay. So that's, because as soon as I see that he's abroad, what my first reaction, and it often is with many of my friends, is what can he get me? Or what can he...
just what you want, something from Manchester.
Well, because you know the point of good hats and good T-shirts is if they're available to everybody, then they have no use for me. But if I'm wearing a Man U or around here,
online, you can get it in four. That's the problem nowadays. You can get it in 4 seconds online. I dig. Did you ever get I love minor league stuff. Like the Lugnuts. I threw out a first pitch once for the Lansing Lugnuts. That was the coolest. You know, they had a Lugnut as their logo. I love that stuff.
Now, how did you do when you threw out the first pitch?
I got there. You know, what no one tells you, if you're ever lucky enough to throw out a first pitch, people who are listening, here's one thing that they don't tell you. Because I did some practice, and I had zero problem reaching the plate. They don't have a good arm, but I have zero problem reaching the plate. What they don't tell you is a pitcher's mound in Major League Baseball is much higher.
Yep.
So if you go up to the mound and you go on the rubber, when you step down, you are pointing down.
You are.
That's what if you watch the great one of John Wall, he throws it basically 4 feet in front of him in the dirt. It's because he steps down and all of a sudden your whole body is pointing down. And by the way, if you are also lucky enough to ever throw out a first pitch at a Yankees game, all of your friends will send you every bad pitch on YouTube that's ever been done. Baba Booey and John Wall and 50 Cent. I got them all.
Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, I got them all. But yes, I did reach the plate. I'm not sure it was a strike. It was a little bit low because of that. But I did reach the plate. It did not hit the dirt, which was all I was really worried about.
Same. I had the same experience. One of my books for kids was The Bat Boy, and it's about a boy who's a Detroit Tigers bat boy for the summer, and on my tour, the Tigers arranged for me to throw out the first pitch, and all the people who gave me advice did a variation of what you just said. This will sound crazy because you're on the mound. Aim high. Aim high.
Right.
Because, and boy, that sucker was diving as it crossed home plate, because I don't know if you had this experience. When my arm got about even with my shoulder, I started choking my brains out. Okay. And I knew, and Zach Lupica, my youngest boy, was with me at Comerica Park. And by the way, Elmore Leonard was there. We'd all gone to the game. It was going to be great. And I started choking my brains out. And Alex Avila, the Tigers catcher, saved my ass because he kept that ball airborne after it crossed home plate. But it's Harlan, it's extremely daunting.
Look, we both have been on, today's show or millions of people watching, and I know you don't get at all nervous. I don't get at all nervous, but I ended up also stupidly getting a box that night. So I had like 20 or 30 friends that were all there at Yankee Stadium, like everyone I knew, all my friends, and I knew I would never hear the end of it. And all of a sudden, right, exactly, that was the most nervous I think I've ever been
for
an event
horrible.
In my life, that throwing that first pitch out. Was the most nervous I have been. I can't, because speaking in front of people, that doesn't bother me, or you either, I know. So I think that was the most nervous I'd ever been, was throwing out that first pitch, because you'll never hear the end of it. And you don't want to be Baba Booey on YouTube. You don't want to be Gary. I still, when I go on that show, I still goof on Gary about it. This many years later, people will still call up and say something to him about it.
We're talking with Harlan Coben on the Mike Lubega Podcast. More with Harlan in a minute. But first, this from Geico. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Go to geico.com and 15 minutes. That's all it takes. And in 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Did you throw from the rubber or did you throw from in front of the mound?
No, the rubber.
Yeah, see.
My friends would not have accepted.
No, see, that's the same thing that happened to me. I go out to, and then, I'm like, Lubega, da, 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 and they hand me the ball. And the kid said, we just got the mound ready for the game. And I said, I don't care. because I said, look over there behind the dugout. That's my son. If I throw from in front of the mound, I will never hear the end of this from now until the end of days. And I just said, he said, no, no, no. And I walked walked right up to the pitcher's mound.
Right. Yeah, you got to do it. Yeah, if you're there, you get one shot at that in your life, probably. You're not going to, you know, you can't blow it up.
My buddy Harlan Coben is my guest on the Mike Lubica podcast. Runaway will be in bookstores and available next Tuesday, March 19th. It will be a huge hit because they all are. Tell me about Safe. How did Safe come to be?
Safe, the five was did very well, and then we wanted to make another show together, Nicholas Schindler and Red Productions and I. And I came up with this idea for Safe, a family community. I wanted something in a gated community, everybody being on top of each other, claustrophobic, everyone thinking they're leading the ideal life, and then a small thing happens and everything goes to hell for three or four different families. And then Michael C. Hall, who had only done two other TV shows, he's only done Six Feet Under and Dexter.
Right.
So that's a pretty good rap. Michael had liked the first one, wanted to meet, and I went to London just to have lunch with Michael C. Hall. And then when we landed him, that's, I think, when the show really started to get off the ground, and we made it for Netflix, and it's done very well for them, and now I've signed a deal where I'll be doing Netflix shows for the next 5 years in different languages, in different countries. The goal is to do one in Spanish in Spain, one in French, one in maybe, and I don't even know what languages because they're doing a lot of international stuff. Then they dub them and bring them over here too, as well as the English language one. So the next show I'm doing, which we started filming now, is called The Stranger. Stars Richard Armitage, who you guys may know from Lord of the Rings and Berlin Station and a bunch of other stuff. He's just an Ocean 8. And Jennifer Saunders from Absolutely Fabulous. Ab Fab is in it, Anthony, Stephen Ray, the great Irish actor from Crying Game. So we have it's a wonderful cast, and we just started filming it. Today is day six of filming, and it's been really kind of fun.
Yes, because another charm of these books, obviously, is that even though they are set, you know, in the United States, that the appeal of stories like this is completely universal and international. And Other than France, okay, where are the books the most popular? I never asked you this before.
Well, it's hard to sound immodest, but they're in 43 languages, so there's not many places that they aren't. They seem to do best. France and England are the two next biggest countries in terms of sales, but they're also bigger countries. Per capita, Poland is really big. You know, a lot of the small... No, it's in Slovenia. It does very well in Thailand and Indonesia. I can't figure out sometimes why we do now. We didn't do well in Germany for a long time. Now the books do well in Germany. They do better in Spain than Italy, Scandinavia. So they're all over. But my biggest countries, I would say, per capita would be France, England, Poland, and Israel, and Thailand. Those are the ones, I guess, that would be the biggest. It's, you know, it's hard to be, you know, to be jaded about that. I mean, there's nothing cooler. You know, you get it too when you get your book sent to you in a foreign language.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, you think of it. I'm sitting here right now in New Jersey, and I write these stories that seem very specific to New Jersey, and that someone in Bulgaria is getting it. It's really cool. I mean, there's no way you can pretend otherwise.
We're talking to my pal Harlan Coben. Runaway is published on March 19th. You, Mr. Bryce Harper, you switched publishers, and I want to know how daunting that was for you.
Yeah, after 17 years, I think it was, I moved. Just Runaway is the first book of a new 5-book deal. But the one thing was my editor had moved over, so I moved over. My editor, Ben Sevier, who had been my editor for all 10 of my New York Times bestsellers, had moved over, so I do feel a little comfortable still being at home. It's really hard to move. But at the same time, sometimes you just have to. It's just time. You need new people. You need new eyes. It's been traumatic. This is the second time only in my career of 31 novels that I've moved, and both times it's been, you know, it's a little bit like a divorce. So it's always hard. I love the people that I left, but I'm really excited about being with Grand Central and back with Ben Sevier. We only missed one book. So, you know, that's the other side of the coin is I'm really excited to have the new publisher. I love the new cover. It's really funky. And I like their energy. So we'll see how it all goes.
What was it like for you? Did you get the bends in 2018, not having a new hardcover come out?
It's been hard, yeah. I had two the year before, so. Well, part of it was that when I was doing TV, especially in 2016, I did two TV shows, The Five, and I did one in France called No Second Chance. And so my publisher was getting a little nervous, and they were like, are you going to have time to write? So almost to prove to them, I wrote two books that year. So one came out in March called Fool Me Once, and one came out in Myron Bolitar called Home in September. So I had done two books in 2016 or 17 that came out, I guess. So I'm still on the one a year. But it has been weird to wait. This is the longest time I've ever gone without having a new book out. And I'm really excited about it. It sounds so self-serving to say that I think Runaway is as good as anything I've ever done or maybe my best. But I still say it, and I still really believe it. I may be fooling myself, but I'm really excited about Runaway coming out. I can't wait for the reaction. This is the fun part for me. So I don't know if I'll be in shape, though. I have a long book tour, and I don't know if I'm in book tour shape because it's been a long time. But it's been hard for me. But I was lucky. I had the release of Safe, the TV show with Michael C. Hall. So I had the fun of that and the excitement of all of that to make up for it.
You know, it's funny. We were talking about Sonny Randall before. Harlan's my pal, so he knew. You know, I knew what I was. It's Robert B. Parker, for God's sakes. And even though he had been my friend, and I'd started reading him when I pulled the Godwolf manuscript off a shelf of a Brentano's on Boylston Street when I was in college. Fear was a good motivator. And then, as you know, I ended up getting the best reviews of my life. People hated Travel Team compared to the reviews I got for Sonny Randall.
Yeah, you did such a great job, and I so admired it. I'm not sure I would have the courage to do, because Robert B. Parker is the best. I mean, there's no other way of putting it.
Well, you've written beautifully
about him. I'm proud to say, I was quoted in his obituary, and my line in his obituary was, 90% of mystery writers admit that Robert B. Parker was an influence, and 10% lie about it. There's been no, in my opinion, there's been no crime writer over the last 50 years who has been more instrumental and influential on all of us than Robert B. Parker. And I say that with all due respect to Elmore Leonard and to Ross McDonald and Sue Grafton,
John D. McDonald,
and a lot of great writers. That's how I feel. So for you to have the nerve to take on Sonny Randall, it's almost sacrilege, and you did it. I'm not pumping sunshine up your skirt because I got no reason to. If you hadn't, I would have let you know too. I would just say, this is not for you. Don't do it. You're gonna hurt yourself. But you really captured the voice in a way that I think Bob would have been proud. So you could take a little pride in that.
Thank you. And when I finished chatting with my friend Harlan Coben today, speaking of the car on the country road, I'm about three or four scenes from the end of Sonny 2, and I'm still not sure. I'm not quite sure where the I know what neighborhood the car is going to end up in. Okay,
right.
But there are several driveways still available to it.
Well, you know, the one thing is you're channeling Parker, and Parker was the same. He never knew how to end the book. I mean, he was not a guy who planned out. I'm sure you've read a bit about Robert Parker.
Yeah, oh sure.
And Lee Child is like this too. They just start. Lee starts, and Robert Parker started, but page one had zero idea where the story was going to go when they start. Again, ask 10 writers how they do it, you'll get 11 different answers. So you're in good hands there.
Talking to Harlan Coben, a couple more questions for Harlan. And again, all people who are fans, and I am a Harlan Coben fanboy and have been for a long time.
By the way, I should point, I could just quickly say, the first time we actually met, how we met is you had mentioned reading one of my books or loving one of my books really nicely in your column.
Yes.
You know.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And I literally have never gotten so many of my friends to call me up and say, did you see Mike Lupica's column? And I'm talking about when I make appearances on the Today Show or our old friends Dennis and Callahan or whatever
yep.
else.
Yep.
I have never gotten that much response from so many of my friends. This is going to sound like one of those stupid interviews, though, where we're just going to, like Joe Franklin, we're just kissing each other's ass. But it was amazing to me. I'm like, I didn't even know you could read. My friends who couldn't read all read your column every day, as you well know. So that was how I contacted you because I read every week also, and I was just like, this is super flattering, dude. I can't thank you enough. And that's how we first started to meet. Now I threw up your question.
Okay. The question is, everybody always wants to know, because as much as we love the standalones, everybody loved Myron and Wynn and all the other characters in it. So is there a Myron in the shoot somewhere?
I think so. I when I'm writing a book, I'm like a boxer. It's the 15th round and I have nothing left, so I can't tell you what my next fight's going to be. You know, it's just like, it's over, Howard. There will be no rematch. It's just I'm exhausted. So, and then I start thinking of an idea. And I then say, who's going to tell that story? And one out of every five or six books, that answer is Myron. I don't plan it in advance. It's an idea that comes to me, and I said, who would tell this story? And it's Myron. So I don't know. I wrote Myron two books ago. The book I'm writing now, which is not Myron, so it'll be three in a row that's not Myron, but maybe the next one will be. I'm feeling him come back a little bit, so I would think not too long till Myron comes back.
Well, as you know, after all the years of our friendship, not enough good things can happen to you to suit me. Good luck with Runaway, not that you're going to need any luck. Good luck on your book tour. By the way, before you go, I have to quote you, okay?
Yes.
You once said, one of my favorite things about book tours, okay? And it was this. You know that 10% of it really helps. You're just never sure which 10%.
It's true. Well, it's true of anything, really, in advertising or marketing or social media or any of that crap. But, yeah, it's, you know, I the other quote I do is Dan Fogelberg from the song Same Old Lang Syne. The audience is heavenly, but the traveling is hell.
It's and by the way, you know, having done books for young readers, that when I went out for Sunny last November, I had just done a kids tour. It's the first time it ever happened to me. It was a jam up. I did two book tours the same month. Okay, but Sunny felt like Club Med, because other than maybe a TV appearance, all I had to do was a bookstore or a library at night. When you're out for a kid's book, it's like two schools, and you feel like a comic on tour. You're doing three appearances a day.
Yeah, I did a young adult trilogy, the Mickey Bolitar series, and as you know, I hated that tour. I was miserable. I think touring for the kids stuff is hard. First of all, yeah, you're doing two or three events a day, not one, and you may be better at this than I am. You never know how the kids are going to react. I'd be sitting there looking in the audience sometimes. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. The kid's just like, this dude is stopping me from getting out. Or they're just checking out, you know, the girl or the guy that they're interested in. They have no interest. Your jokes are flat. You're like, who is this old, bald old man talking to me right now? So I admire the fact that I hated book touring for the young adult.
See, I love the kids part of it because
I shouldn't be writing young adults. I don't like kids very much. No, I'm kidding. I did it in my own town. My kids were so horrified. They were just like, oh, Dad, you can't do that. That's so embarrassing.
Runaway by Harlan Coben, yep. March 19th. I will urge you to get it, but people don't need much urging at this point. Thanks for doing this, pal.
Thanks,
and good luck with
it's
the book.
Great. Love talking to you, pal.
Harlan Coben on the Mike Lubica podcast. And again, the fun of doing this is I get to have conversations like this, not just with people I want to talk to, but with friends like Harlan. So continue. We're doing this twice a week now for a reason. People wanted to hear more of this. Continue to download, continue to subscribe, and we'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lubica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative.
For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.